Welcome back, SPC Nation. Before we get into today's episode of the Second Print Comics Podcast, I got to stop you for 1 second and tell you to head over to our brand new sponsor's website. The website is foxandsons.com, F-O-X, the letter N, S-O-N-S.com. What do? They make fantastic coffee beans and they deliver them right to your door. He doesn't make the beans, let's be honest. He sources them from amazing, incredible sources, but he gets them right to your door. I'll tell you that. And they're fantastic. I get these 2 pound bags delivered to my house every single month. And right now, Steven is offering a special deal, $4 off any subscription to these 2 pound bags, or you can use a little SPC discount for any order over $25. You'll get a 15% discount by using discount code SECONDPRINTPOD. You got to spell it all out, that SECONDPRINTPOD, to get yourself 15% off your order over at foxandsons.com. Check it out. Welcome, SPC Nation. I've got a very special guest here today. He is the proprietor of the Secret Sun blog, as well as the author of a number of books, including, most relevant to today's discussion, the book Our Gods Wear Spandex, The Secret History of Comic Book Heroes. I'm very pleased to welcome Chris Knowles. Welcome to SPC.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
All right, Chris. Well, I think we should just start at, the beginning for you anyway. So just to give a little bit of background on yourself so everybody kind of gets where you're coming from here, maybe you could just give some of your background on, I guess, your research and interest in the occult, the subject of the occult, but also your own background in the comic book industry.
Well, I started reading comic books when I was 3. It's how I learned how to read. I started in the industry fairly early. When I was 17, I went to work for New England Comics. I was their first full-time manager at their store in Quincy Center in Massachusetts. I went to comic book school, the Kubert School. Started working in New York doing stuff for like Disney and Warner Brothers. You name it, Batman, Superman, Street Fighter, every possible licensed property that you could imagine I was working on. Did some work in advertising. And then in 1995, I started working for Toy Biz, which is the company that eventually became Marvel. When Marvel went into bankruptcy, Toy Biz bought them out. And I started doing package design for them in January 1995, and I freelanced doing Marvel character art until 2020, and so that's 25 years, pretty solid. I mean, I was doing a lot of other stuff in between as well. I was doing a lot of advertising and storyboards and just, I mean, you name it. I did some comic book work, all kinds of stuff. So I've done kind of pretty much a little of everything in the industry. I worked for, I was an associate editor on a magazine called Comic Book Artists, which was a big magazine back in the day, five-time Eisner Award winning magazine. I wrote Our Gods Wear Spandex in 2006, was published in 2007. I did a bunch of documentaries and some television appearances, radio stuff, promoting that book. So I have a pretty, my entire adult life, like into the, sort of the lip of my adolescence, the final days of my adolescence into my, if you talk about adult life being 18, which I don't know if I necessarily agree with, but
I'm 43 and I'm still deciding if I'm.
Yeah. So I was, I've been working in the industry on Marvel, DC, a number of different characters, doing where the real money is, which is in the merchandising, toy design. I did a lot of toy design in the 90s. Toy packaging design. And like I said, I've done pretty much everything you can name. And I wrote A Gods Wear Spandex because it was kind of like, where did the superheroes come from? What's the lineage? What's the... um, you know,
your origin, if you will.
Yeah. Well, because really what it comes from is that it really starts in the 19th century with the rise of theosophy and, you know, similar movements, and then movements like the Golden Dawn and, you know, the Rosicrucians and the Freemasons, which had already been around.
Can you just take a brief kind of like a, I want to do like a 101, maybe just on theosophy and that concept, so people kind of get a little bit of a sense of where we're coming from. I know a lot of this is stuff you talk about a lot, but a lot of this audience may have never heard of this stuff before. So maybe just give a briefing on theosophy. Maybe it might be a good place to start.
All right. So theosophy was a movement that arose out of spiritualism. And spiritualism was a movement that arose in the wake of the Civil War. And it had to do with spirit contact and seances and mediums and so on. And I mean, most of it was showbiz, really. Most of it was fraud. But then this Russian woman emigrated to the United States, this woman called Helena Protovna Blavatsky. Pretty sure she was mixed up with like the Tsar's secret police. She got involved with a lot of rich and influential men in New York, started the Theosophical Society, which is really the prototype for the New Age movement, because it sort of combined like esoteric Christianity with Hinduism, Buddhism, and occultism. And, you know,
a little something for everyone.
A little something for everyone. Now, the movement really kind of sputtered out, interestingly enough, in the wake of the Russian Revolution. So that sort of speaks to who was really driving the train there. Blavatsky died fairly early. A woman named Annie Besant took over. They picked up stakes and kind of moved to India, and they got very involved in the Indian nationalist movement. So I think that also kind of speaks to who was paying the bills in this movement. They chose this young man called Krishnamurti and, you know, announced that he was like the avatar, the Maitreya, as they called him, Lord Maitreya. He was the new Buddha that was going to save all of mankind. That didn't work out. He didn't want to get really involved with them, but they did along the way get involved with Gandhi, people like that, all these people in the Indian nationalist movement. Then you had outgrowths of theosophy. You had Anthroposophy, which was Rudolf Steiner's variant, which is still very much around. He formed the Waldorf schools, which are very elite public private schools. And then you had the Lucis Trust with Alice Bailey, which I think was British intelligence answer to theosophy. And what we had in the 20s and 30s was what were called pulp magazines. Pulp magazines were short story magazines printed on extraordinarily cheap paper. I mean, just, you know, it was pulp because it was just barely a grade. It was barely a grade above like just pure wood pulp. It seemed to like yellow and fall apart as you read these magazines. And it's very hard to find pulps today because they're all just completely disintegrating because, you know, the paper was so high in acid content. So, there was a number of the first superheroes were really printed in these magazines, and there was the Shadow, which was just basically Batman, the forerunner to Batman, except for he used 45s, twin 45s. There was Doc Savage, who was the forerunner to Superman. There were a number of other characters like the Avenger and the Spider, which sort of became, through various twisting permutations, you know, the Avengers and Spider-Man, just a number of, so these were really the first superheroes, but they, their powers did not come from science. Their powers came from the occult. They all, you know, went to the quote unquote Orient, which is usually the Himalayas, to study with the Swamis and the Fakirs and all these kind of the seedy mystics and all these kind of people, and you know, learn superpowers. Hold on a sec, Jimmy. Thanks. anyhow, so, you know, they're very popular, but what had happened is that during the war, there was paper rationing, and the pulps were really affected by the paper rationing. For some reason, other magazines were not, but the comic books came in, and the comic books really started, like, literally as they would take old Sunday comics sections and cut them up and sew them back together. And these became very popular. So this would be like, you know, Buster Brown and the Cats and Jam of Kids and, you know, Blondie. I mean, all these old comic strips, Little Nemo, whatever. And they were replaced by more original material. And the first big superhero was, you know, the Doc Strange, but also a sort of a copy of this character called the Gladiator. These two kids from Cleveland, Siegel and Schuster, their big innovation was to give the super, you know, change the superheroes from like street clothes, which they wore in the pulps, and gave them like, you know, these circus costumes, you know what I'm saying? Like these circus strongman costumes, which is really what Superman's wearing. But Superman had an immediate predecessor as well by Siegel and Schuster called the Dr. Occult. The Dr. Occult starts off as just...
That one's pretty on the nose, huh?
Yeah, right? Your typical kind of occult detective. There are a lot of these. You know, people like Seabury Quinn and Dion Fortune. There were a lot of people writing, Sax Rohmer, writing occult detectives, you know, detectives who specifically investigated the occult. And Dr. Occult went from wearing, you know, like a trench coat and a fedora and so on, to dressing more what we would recognize as Superman. He's wearing like, you know, briefs, you know, tidy whities, I guess, and a cape. But, you know, otherwise, you know, he's kind of naked, which is kind of interesting. But the character that Jerry Siegel invented after Superman became popular was a character called the Spectre, mm-hmm. which was this cop named Jim Corrigan, who's killed and is resurrected to become this avenging angel, like this literal avenging angel. So Jerry Siegel was very much interested in occultism. And a matter of fact, you know, he kind of had all these struggles with DC, who were the publishers. They were called National at the time. But he ended up putting a curse, you know, like a public curse on them. Like, I curse you because of the Superman movie, because they kind of got cut out of the royalties. And what ended up happening is that there was so much bad publicity over this that DC ended up giving them a stipend, like a, you know, little kind of, I think it was like $20,000 a year, which in the
70s. Is that how we got Superman 4? Was that the curse?
Yeah, right. And 3, right? Right. Yeah. But it's interesting too.
At least we got Richard Pryor in 3. But
well, you know, look what happened to Richard Pryor, and look what happened to Christopher
maybe,
Reeve.
Maybe the curse goes on. Yeah, wow.
Yeah, you know, Margot Kidder. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, there is a long line, I guess, of people associated with
tragedy. Yeah. And actually, Siegel... you know, both Siegel and Schuster had issues, let's just say. I mean, Siegel, well, Joe Schuster had a lot of vision problems from very early on, so he started using a lot of other artists to help him. But he kind of dropped out of comics and was doing like bondage porn, like, you know, BDSM, you know, whips and chains, all that kind of stuff. And Jerry Siegel, I think he might have had a little bit of a sweet tooth for the young boys, let's just say. You know, of course, we have Jimmy Olsen, which was just...
Is this where all the teenage sidekicks come from?
Yeah. Well, the teenage sidekicks really start with Robin, and that's a whole other story. I, you know, there are like comic stories where like they sleep in the same bed and so on. It's just so weird. And Robin is like 8 years old in the comic strips. It's just so wrong. But Jerry Siegel, he created some other characters. One was called Nature Boy, and one was called Mr. Muscles. And Mr. Muscles had this like thin young boy, this thin, sensitive young boy who tagged along. It was just really sketchy. It was just like really kind of Nambla. But, there's so much of that in the old comics. And it's kind of like, you talk about, ruin your childhood. It's like when I started seeing like all these kind of indications of just how unwholesome a lot of the appetites a lot of these writers and artists were, I was just like, oof, oh god.
They never meet your heroes, never find out what your heroes were into.
Yeah, like once you start to notice what they were doing in some of these stories and some of the symbolism and just like flat out Freudian insanity, it's hard to unsee. It's hard to unsee.
So does this extend into some of our, we were primarily talking about DC and the origins of things there. Does this extend into like Stan Lee and our more beloved names that we always consider somewhat sacred, or is there anything we can still?
No, not so much. I mean, Stan Lee was a much different kind of guy. Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. I mean, Steve Ditko who co-created Doctor Strange and Spider-Man. He was a little weird. I don't know if he was, I don't know if he was banned from, being living within 200 feet of a public school or something. I mean, I don't know, but when you start looking at his stuff, it gets kind of weird too. But a lot of it is like when you're just sitting in a room by yourself and you're just alone with your thoughts. Particularly artists who are already screwed up, right? Your thoughts can just start going to some pretty dark places. Your fantasies. When you're constantly having to delve into these fantasies, it can kind of get a little sketchy. So, that's neither here nor there. But I don't think Stan Lee really, I don't see a lot of that in Marvel books at all. Hmm. And
Do you think Marvel was more just trying to take what DC had already done successfully and it's just kind of essentially ripping it off and in some ways being more successful at their ripoff?
Yeah, no. I would say, obviously Captain Marvel, who we know as Shazam now, and there's another character, the sort of gender swapped Captain Marvel, which the less said about the better. That was like a pure, it was just a flat out. And, the publisher of Captain Marvel, Fawcett, and DC, who were publishing Superman, they were like in court for years over that. And finally, Fawcett just gave up the character because, comic books and superheroes were really on the wane. And plus, they had the Dennis the Menace license, which back in the 50s, that was a license to print money because that strip was huge. And you still see, I don't know if they still have Dennis the Menace in Dairy Queen, but yeah. So, superheroes... You can't really say that Marvel was ripping off DC because DC was ripping off the pulps.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? They're all sort of drinking from the same well. Nobody ripped off Superman because Superman is a ripoff in my way of thinking. Superman is just a ripoff. The interesting thing that Jerry Siegel did, though, is that he made him an alien. Right. And that was like a new spin. People forget that Superman is an alien. He's not just like a super guy. He's from another planet, and it's the whole Moses and the reed boats on the Nile kind of deal, but it's just a rocket ship, right?
And that was introduced before the current sort of, I would say the current era of UFO alien hysteria started more like in the 1940s.
Right. But there were the science fiction pulps, but it was in a much different context. It wasn't, but it's interesting too, because you could kind of argue that Superman is like the prototype of the more like religious cast of.
He's like a Christ figure almost that's come to.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So you kind of see that, you could kind of see him in that context, that he's more similar to, that messianic space brother kind of thing that became more popular in the 50s, right? More popular in the 50s. So, yeah, but occultism and the paranormal. So what it is, like I said, is that these OG superheroes, the pulp superheroes, all got their powers, you know, from the same kinds of pulp and pop occultism, you know, ironically, that we're advertising, you know, because the Rosicrucians used to advertise in the pulps.
Oh, wow. So they were literally, these groups that were into this stuff were actually literally then funding these pulps, which directly led to the same superheroes we know today.
Exactly. So it sort of becomes a loop. So, I mean, you know, these characters are all kind of savior figures in a way, right? They're all self-sacrificing classical heroes, right? Because, you know, heroes in the old days were tragic figures, really. I mean, if you read the old Greek myths, all the great heroes, you know, have bad ends. You know, they all come to sort of bad ends. Because that's just the way the Greeks sort of saw the world, you know, is this bitter struggle with natural forces and so on. And that, you know, there's constant state of war between all these city states and whatever. So, you know, the heroes really are you know, messiahs in a way. And they sort of have the same end, you know. I mean, Christ has the same arc that we see, you know, these characters that are self-sacrificing heroes that die. They put their lives on the line to save the rest of us.
And then with Superman, he literally died and was resurrected as well.
Yeah. Came back with a mullet. So really, you know, as somebody who, like I said, I grew up on this stuff. I started reading like early 70s, right? To me, we've just been in a tape loop since like the mid 80s. Now, there are two sort of landmark works that I kind of see as the summation of comics and superheroes. And that's Frank Miller did a series called The Dark Knight Returns. And Alan Moore did a miniseries called Watchmen. Mm-hmm. And these were like sort of, to me, they were like the capper. They were the last thing that could possibly be said about superheroes, because since that time, everything has just been, rehash. I mean, it was rehash before that. I mean, how many times can the Joker fight Batman, right? I mean, I was sick of it, you know, in the 80s. I was just like, okay, yeah, I get it. Yeah, Joker's fighting the Batman. And that's 40 years ago now. 40 years ago. I mean, just think about that. So we're really at an interesting point now, because as we're recording, as we're streaming here, I've been keeping an eye on the, you know, the box office grosses of The Flash. Mm-hmm. And it's just over. The superheroes, I mean, I've been saying this for a couple of years now, you know, because since I see these trend lines from an inside point of view, I can see the way things are proceeding a little farther down the line than I think, you know, normies and civilians can, as they're called in the fandom world. But, you know, we've had just flop after flop, and underperformer after underperformer. Superhero movies have really kept the lights on in Hollywood for the past 10, 15 years now, right? And it's over. It's done. It's finished. It's
you would think with this Flash movie too that they're at least going to get that nostalgia boost from Michael Keaton, but and yet this movie is performing worse than Black Adam. You know, it's worse than some of the worst movies in the past few years. So, and they pretty much threw everything at this one, and despite all the online buzz, that hasn't translated into dollars as well. So there's a reality on the ground where you can definitely see. I don't know if you just think it's the oversaturation or if there's some other reason that they're just failing so much, the wokeness, whatever you want to call it. There's a million reasons you could point to, but it does feel like even hardcore fans are like, ugh, I've had enough.
everything lives and dies. Everything has its natural life cycle, and myths are not forever. Look at the Westerns. The Westerns were the great American myth, weren't they? For 100 years, really, up until the early 70s. Early 70s, mid 70s. I mean, you still had big budget Westerns being made. And then they became much rarer, right? I mean, you still had like Unforgiven and Tombstone and, you know, some big, but it wasn't like anything like what it was. And we're going to be seeing the same thing with superheroes, but it might be worse because these movies are unimaginably expensive to make. Mm-hmm. I don't think that people really understand how.
And somehow they still come out with really shitty animation, shitty CGI. It's unbelievable.
We're past peak CGI. CGI is really hard to do, right? I have a friend who was a computer animator in the video game industry back in the 90s, and he was really successful at it. And he walked away because he was like, I don't want to die of a heart attack or of cancer, because he just saw people in his business dropping dead, 30s, early 40s. You know what I'm saying? Just like literally just dropping dead at their desk.
Just from the man hours and the work. And
it's just unbelievably stressful. And, you know, you've got a new coterie of kids who just don't have that kind of like self-sacrificing work ethic. Hmm. Why should you sacrifice your life for Warner Brothers or Disney's profits? Right. I mean, what the hell does it do for you? So I don't blame them whatsoever. I think that they're spot on. But the problem is, you know, it isn't a problem for me, but it's definitely a problem for, you know, for Bob Iger and, you know, David Zaslav and all these other studio heads who are like, oh, you know, it's interesting now because people are starting to notice. I mean, I've started to notice how CGI has gotten bad, and some more specialist kind of people like on YouTube have been pointing this out for a few years now, but now it's like the big story with the Flash is like, why is the CGI so terrible? And
for a movie that was pushed back like four or five. I mean, this is supposed to come out years ago originally.
Well, the movie's been in production at least 10 years, right? So, the same thing happened with Ant-Man. Like people are like, why does this look like crap? Well, it looks like crap because CGI is really expensive. It's really labor intensive. You're counting on a fairly small amount of people who can do the work well. And what you're doing is you're just burning them out and they're not going to be replaced. So I genuinely feel that once the strike is over, and you know, SAG, which is Screen Actors Guild, they're talking about striking, and AFTRA's talking about striking. I think they reached some sort of agreement with the Directors Guild. These movies are really expensive. They're really time intensive. The studios don't want to pay the amount of money because they're just not, you know, in the age when with the age of free money is over. People were like, how could the studios just afford to make all these movies that weren't making any money back, especially with the end of the DVD market, right? Well, they could do that because they just had a constant flow of interest-free loans, which is just like free money, you know? And half the time, they weren't even expected to even pay it back, right? So those days are over. We may see things starting up in like Asia, like maybe India and China, and they're sick of Hollywood too. So they're going to want to start to make their own versions of these films. So it'll be interesting to see how that will play out. I don't see them gaining a lot of traction in the West. I mean, certainly not the way like Japanese and Korean stuff has, because that's a different kind of culture, you know? Japanese and Korean culture have always been like
dark and twisted is what I always think.
Not only that, but you know, they've always been, you know, since the end of the, since the post-war era, they've been very obsessed with American culture. So what they've done is that they've sort of taken American pop culture, put their own little spin on it, and then sent it back, you know, with a sort of exotic, cutesy spin that, you know, young kids, especially kind of young shut-in kids today, you know, find really appealing. I mean, but the thing is, it's like, anybody who's like got an anime or a manga avatar on Twitter is usually going to be saying some pretty heinous shit about like kids, and you know what I mean?
The odds are high enough. Yeah.
Yeah. Whenever I see it's like my hackles go up whenever I see somebody with an anime avatar. Cause I'm like, all right, they're either going to be trans, communist, maps, right? Maps. Satanists, you know,
there will be intersecting
combination of the four. What's that?
There will be intersecting of a few of these, most likely, right?
Yeah, so it's not altogether wholesome.
I'm curious if you think, you know, because especially in the movies in the last few years, whether it's Marvel or DC, it seems like what started as a minor novelty sometimes is now the entire basis of every film property is this multiverse thing where everything is the multiverse. And now we're bringing back past versions of other characters. Do you think this whole multiverse push on every side of this thing is really just the last gasps of air for the superhero industry, you might call it? Is it just the last thing we got to try to throw, you know, every little bit of nostalgia, every little bit of weird crossover we can do to try to get the last drops of money about anybody who's kind of remaining standing at this point?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you what it ties into. I'll tell you what it ties directly into. So I talked about Watchmen and Dark Knight, right? Well, that same time period that DC did a book called Crisis on Infinite Earths, which was a big multiverse crossover. You know, the story back then is that they had so many different timelines going on that they sort of wanted to just boil them down to a single timeline that the fans could follow. The multiverse stories, it is grasping at straws, but it's also a way to, like, you know, have big dramatic moments with your hero getting killed, and you know, you can just, you know, reach into the wormhole and grab another version. Right. Right? You know what I'm saying? It's lazy storytelling, but it's also just, I mean, you know, after Endgame, right? You know, with Thanos just kind of destroying half the universe's population. I mean, how do you follow on with that? And this is a problem that the comic books had in the 70s. I mean, I can speak to this being there. The same problems that the cinematic superhero universes are having, the publishers had the exact same problems in the 70s. Interestingly enough, you know, so when you saw these phase four characters, Black Widow, Shang-Chi, Eternals, forget who else.
you forget for a reason. So
yeah. Yeah. I mean, none of these movies really flew, but these were all characters that I was a big fan of back when I was a kid. Right. But none of them were really popular. You know, none of these characters really had a constituency. I mean, I was a huge fan of Shang-Chi, which is in a book called, he was a character in a book called Master Kung Fu. You know, and the Eternals was Jack Kirby, who was like my guy at the time. He didn't really know what to do with it. Eternals was not a strong concept. Eternals are characters that you put in an Avengers movie. It's like the Avengers are like flying around, oh, we've got to fight this, and no, oh, here's Thanos and everything. You know, who do we call on for help? You know, and they get on the little Avengers phone and they call the Eternals. That's kind of who they are, right? They're just not very strong characters in and of themselves.
The interesting thing about the Eternals in Jack Kirby's original Eternals is that, you know, some of them were actually which they kind of do in the movie too in an even stupider way, is they say some of them used to be like the old gods of old, like literally not just referencing the gods and the ideas of having powers, but they were these gods like Hermes and whatnot. So
that's
a little less subtle with the occult references there.
That's Kirby. I mean, Kirby was really heavily into ancient astronaut stuff in the late 50s. And he was doing ancient astronaut stories in like 57. All right. So this is 10 years before Chariots of the Gods, 5 years before Morning of the Magicians. And he was just doing it straight up. You know, I mean, he was really into this whole concept. And but he was also, I mean, he was into everything, you know, like all the kind of crazy stuff. And a lot, I mean, really, it's so funny to me because, you know, when I was a kid in the 70s, like I was still like a big Kirby loyalist, but like most fans hated his stuff, right? And they're into like the X-Men and so on. And the interesting thing about it is that a lot of those movies were just using, you know, characters and ideas that he had created in all these comic books that nobody liked back in the 70s, which I always found kind of interesting. But the whole, I mean, the whole Marvel universe was really the Kirby universe, right? I mean, Thanos is just a direct, well-acknowledged ripoff of a character Kirby created called Darkseid, for the a book called The New Gods,
which couldn't be more direct in and of itself.
Yeah, yeah, well, and George Lucas basically just ripped off the archetypes of the New Gods for Star Wars. I mean, there was even, you know, like there's even like the Force in New Gods. It's called the Source. Mm-hmm. Right, it's that simple, and really when you look at
Darkseid, Darth Vader.
Well, exactly, but even more than Darkseid, Darth Vader is just Doctor Doom from Fantastic Four.
Yeah, well, there you go.
And
yeah.
You know, I don't know how many of your listeners might be familiar with our character.
Well, very, very much so. You're in the right place for the nerdy references. So.
Same exact character, you know, like the young scientific prodigy, but he was also, you know, he's into the occult and mysticism, and then he's horribly scarred and burnt, and then he's encased in armor. It's the same friggin' character. And it's interesting too, because if you look
One of those I can't believe I never made that connection. Now it's so obvious.
Well, here's another one. Like the crew of the Millennium Falcon. So it's like Han, Chewbacca, Leia, and Luke Skywalker. That's the Fantastic Four. And you know, it's like this, you know, if
Chewie is the thing.
Yeah, like Chewbacca's the thing, right? And
totally. Han is Johnny Storm, the hothead.
Luke is Johnny Storm, right? Because he's
okay, yeah, you know, the young brash, right?
You know, yeah. Sue and Johnny Storm, it's the same. Like people go, oh, you know, George Lucas was reading Joseph Campbell and you know, watching Kurosawa films. Like, no, he wasn't. He was reading Jack Kirby comic books. It's just straight up. And Raiders of the Lost Ark is lifted straight from Kirby's Black Panther series. Because Kirby's Black Panther series was all about, like, you know, raiding King Solomon's tomb and, you know, these sort of adventurous characters who go around the world looking for relics and something. And a lot of the ideas in his series were also in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. I mean, it's like so much of Star Wars.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
And Star Wars is pure pastiche. I don't take Star Wars seriously. I just don't. It offends me as somebody who's into the history of this stuff because it's such a cut and paste job. You know what I mean? It's so obviously just a collage of other people's ideas. And which is fine, but if you know the original ideas, you just can't process it the same way. And you know, there's so much Kirby in Star Wars that it's just even like C-3PO is based on a character, a Kirby character called the Recorder. So it looks not entirely dissimilar. It's like this android, and you know, he accompanies Thor on these adventures and so on. So it's all just rehash. But the, you know, when you talk about Hollywood, you know, it's like the well is run dry. So, you asked me about wokeness and stuff. And wokeness to me is just the opportunistic infection. Mm-hmm. You know, like Hollywood skinned its knee, 10, 15 years ago. And, all these microbes infected it. And the microbes were like all the woke people.
So the wokeness is like the flies on this already dying carcass. So like, it's like, let's pick up the scraps. Yeah. Let's put our shit out here on this thing that's going down anyway.
Well, not quite a carcass, but like I'm saying, it's the opportunistic infection. You know, I don't think woke in and of itself did not cause the death of superheroes in Hollywood and everything. They just took advantage of it. They just capitalized on it. But the infection was already setting in.
Because if something is already trending downward and already dying, it's more susceptible to just some hotshot executives coming in and saying, all right, well, we're just making the lesbian everything now, or the black everything now, you know?
Well, exactly. Exactly. And a lot of it's like the kind of people who kind of like run Hollywood now. And it's people who hire their friends. You know, you get people who come in, you know, from women's studies programs or something, they get a job in Hollywood, you know, back in the woke virtual signaling free money days, right? When they could just afford to indulge these people, kind of keep them quiet with these make work jobs. But the problem is that these people come in, they start making trouble, all this Me Too stuff. They start scheming against, you know, these older guys in these corner offices, they scheme to get them kicked out and them fired and disgraced. And then they hire all their friends from women's studies and culture, gender studies, and all these people that they knew in school. And that's really what we see. I mean,
what you're saying really does explain a lot, because you'll see a lot of these writers that get brought on, especially to a lot of these Marvel movies and Marvel shows, and you'll see interviews with them, and they'll almost brag about how they never read the comics and don't care about the characters. So they have to like ask their one nerdy friend questions. And it's like, and these are the people being put in charge of overseeing these characters. So there's no wonder there's such a disparity between the product and the actual, like whatever might remain of the hardcore fan base.
Exactly. Exactly. So, and I saw this this happened in the comics too. So what happened starting about 15 years ago, the places where these people would normally go, mainstream media, academic journals, academia, all these sort of places that had berths for your gender studies and your cultural studies and your black studies and all these kind of people graduating from these programs, those jobs just started to vanish. You know, particularly newspapers and magazines and so on. So it's like comics came along and they sort of saw an opportunity, because the interesting thing about comics, and I'm going to be stepping all over all kinds of toes here, but you know, comics, as somebody who was involved in the milieu since a very, very early age, you know, fandom and so on. Let's just say that comics is filled with weak men, okay? Mm-hmm. And these companies, a lot of these companies are run by weak men, and weak men who are naturally subservient to strong women and naturally fall in line with, you know, because it's all like kind of Oedipal mother stuff, you know what I mean? Because most of the people had like major father, like major daddy issues and so on, and strong attachments to the maternal energies, right? The maternal aspect. But, you know, just like kind of nerds, you know, just like guys who didn't get a lot of action in high school. A lot of them like in their 40s and they're still virgins, right? You know, they're easy marks. And I think a lot of these women came in and they, you know, it's well known that they would get on these like message boards and these secret Facebook groups and so on and plot like, how are we going to get rid of this guy and that guy? And how are we going to take their jobs? And how are we going to take
really? All and that openly?
What's that?
Like that openly?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it wasn't that openly until people, you know, infiltrated these groups and started posting the screenshots and so on. Right. But it was that deliberate. It's like X amount of women's studies, gender studies, cultural studies, majors, graduates, very poor career prospects. And, you know, I mean, the thing that has to be said is that, you know, say a lot of these people end up at like Marvel Comics or something, they're making next to nothing. Mm-hmm. And the salaries are, you know, salaries are pathetic. I mean, I worked for Marvel and the company that preceded Marvel for 25 years, right? And in the good old days, meaning the days before Disney bought them, that was the end of the glory days. But in the good old days before Disney bought Marvel, like I'd go up there all the time, right? And I just hang out with like people who worked there, you know, like the people that I worked for, because they were all just like super, super cool people. And one time I was doing this interview with these students from Toronto who wanted to make a documentary on comic books and everything. So they wanted to interview me because our Gods Wear Spandex had just come out. And it was funny because it was a day during a blizzard in New York, right? And I said to these guys, these kids, right? I said, hey, you want to go up to Marvel? And they're like, what? I'm like, yeah, come on. I'll take you up to Marvel. You know, you can, you know, get the tour. And I was hoping that they could film, right? And so we get up there and my boss says, you know, they don't want you filming up here and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, well, that's cool. So whatever. But I was just taking around introducing them to people, right? But so this is like the divisions of Marvel that were making money, right? Like the movies and the toys and all this kind of stuff. The actual comic folks, the guy who is like the big deal superstar editor-in-chief, his office was literally a converted broom closet in the back, like near the emergency exit. You know what I mean? So you're in this main floor, right? And there's like accounting over here, and there's like, you know, consumer products here, and this and that over here, legal here, whatever. And then there's editorial. And at the time, editorial was like this little, you know, like two or three or four offices at the most.
It's the exact opposite impression that you have, at least that I would have growing up reading these comics, always seeing that same name, you know, editor chief. You always picture, oh, this is the big wig. This is the guy with the fancy office. Yeah. You know, this is the guy who runs the place.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, that's here's the ugly truth that people within the industry have always acknowledged is that since the kind of the post Batman 60s collapse, you know, so the comics were huge. So you had like Fantastic Four and Spider-Man and all these kind of books in the 60s. And then you also had the Batman TV show, which was just a phenomenon, right? But then there was the post Bat. So Batman, I think, was canceled in 68 or 69. And there's just the whole thing just kind of falls in on itself. And, it really starts like these, you know, so like in the 60s, like Superman was selling like 800,000 copies a month, something crazy like that, right? And now it sells like, I don't know, 20,000, 30,000. I mean,
oh yeah, the physical books, even the high selling books. You know, it's funny because DC Comics, I mean, I think Batman is typically their highest selling character, but still, to make enough Batman sales on Batman and what might have been two or three books nowadays, they just put out like 12 Batman books a month. And then because they know if they just put Batman on it, it will sell enough. But even that, they have to like overproduce and overmarket it just to
it doesn't sell enough though. So let me just finish my story here. So I took these kids up and, you know, I was having them, there was a VP there who, I sort of was like my main contact at the time, whenever I was working on a project for Marvel. And, you know, he was great because he's like answering all their questions about what's coming up. But a couple of years later, I had lunch with the same VP, right? And he said to me flat out, he said, comic books do not make any money for Marvel, period. He said, they are a loss leader. This is 2012, mind you. This is over a decade ago. And he's like, they do not make money. And this was at a time when they were trying to get into the bookstore market and they were putting all like original graphic novels and so on and all this kind of stuff out in the book markets. And he's like, we are losing so much money on that stuff. And it wasn't long after that, you know, Ike Perlmutter, who is, you know, the CEO at the time, just said, don't stop. No more original graphic novels, you know, and any of this stuff. You know, the only stuff that they would put in the stores were reprints, you know, collections, trade paperbacks, but no original stuff, no original material, none of the hardcovers, none of this kind of stuff that they were doing, that they were just losing money absolutely hand over fist on. And so in the 90s, early 90s, maybe it was late 80s, I don't know, I was taking classes at School of Visual Arts in New York, right? And one of my teachers was this guy named Carmine Infantino. And Carmine Infantino was like the guy who sort of recreated Batman in the 60s. It was called like, I think it was called The New Trend or whatever. But he was like an artist who had been in the business since the 40s. And then he became editor-in-chief of DC. And then he got fired by Warner's because of the whole thing with the Superman movie. But anyhow, I mean, he told me, he said, DC does not make any money on comic books. This is 1990. This is like the post, I mean, this is like Batmania volume 2. And everybody thought comic books were like the wave of the future. Everybody thought everything, I mean, everything was like selling like 500,000 copies or whatever. I mean, you know, it's just ridiculous. So this is 1990. This is, like 6 months or so after the Batman movie came out, and it was like the biggest thing. I mean, I remember going to Earth Day in taking my kids or my son to Earth Day in 1989. And this was like a month or two before the Batman movie came out. And everyone in New York City was wearing a Batman shirt. It was just everywhere. I mean, it was just in the air. So, but he, you know, he said, he's like, they don't make any money on those comics. It's like they only publish them to keep the copyrights active, you know, and to develop stuff that they might use for toys or movies or whatever. It's just like, it's not even like R&D though. It's just like a loss leader.
That explains why it seems like some days you see books that are put out and stories that are put out that it's like you literally read some of these books and you wonder how they exist, because, you know, and then that explains it though, because if they don't even care, if they've already sort of accepted that they're loss leaders, that they're just publishing to publish, then if they don't care, of course the product is going to reflect that.
Well, you know, if you're talking about like the stuff they're doing now where everybody's gay and everybody's race swapped and everything, the only reason they're doing that stuff, I mean, because none of those books sell at all, like literally don't, nobody buys them, nobody reads them. I mean, stores will order them, and that's what they count as sales, because the customer for the comic book companies is not the paying customer. It's not the reader. It's the store owners, because of the way the system is set up. But anyhow, they just do that stuff for clickbait stories, pure publicity. I mean, they know that nobody wants to read like Superman's gay son stories. They know that nobody wants to read this stuff. They know nobody wants to read like, you know, Gwen Stacy is trans or whatever. They know nobody cares about this stuff, right? The people who do care about it, the people who talk about it on some of these fan sites, they don't read the comics. And if they do, they just read them on bootleg sites, right? Pirate sites. They don't read this shit. And, you know, Marvel and DC know that. It's just all about getting stories in on CNN.com or whatever. It's pure and simple. It's just visibility. It's just keeping the characters visible. Because they could, so here's the thing. So say you did like every, you know, you're like, we're going to make every hardcore fan, of which there are only like 250,000 in the US and only have been, like, that number stayed like frighteningly consistent since the early 70s. So we're going to keep this 250,000 base of fans happy, right? Give them everything they want, give them all the characters they want, right? It doesn't matter. Because, you know, they're not making money in the book. So it's just like, all right, well, we're going to drive off the fans, you know, who most of these guys, single white males in their 40s and 50s, you know, nobody wants those guys, right? And we're just going to just write them off because we need to get our, we need to keep our characters visible with all these ridiculous, woke, nonsensical stories. And that's what they do. I mean, all this woke stuff, it's just 100% straight, no chaser publicity stunts. Up and down the line, no exceptions at all. At all.
I saw people talking about just the death of the Punisher, the committing suicide, that it had never read comics, don't care about comics, but they were absolutely outraged by it. So it's always just the people that aren't, would never be talking about this in the first place, it seems.
Well, the Punisher is a character who, like, you know, your cultural studies majors, you know, these people who will work at a job in Manhattan for $30,000 a year, right? And that's another thing we should talk about is this whole comics broke me hashtag that's been going on around on Twitter. But anyhow, you know, they hate it. They hate that character because it represents everything that they hate. In other words, it represents their fathers. All these people, so comic books has always been sort of a refuge for people who have problems with their fathers. And I'm not the guy who pointed that out. There was, I think it was an old DC editor named Andy Helfer, who I think pointed mm-hmm. that out. You know, like, most of this stuff is for people who have problems with their fathers. And the biggest daddy issue people in the world are like your gender studies and your women's studies and your culture studies and your, you know, your race studies. I mean, all these, people who rack up ridiculous amounts of college debt for near useless degrees, right? I'm totally useless now. I mean, they were only near useless when all these horny 40-year-old virgins at these big comic companies would hire these mostly relatively attractive young women, you know what I'm saying? Because they liked having them around. They smelled good, right? It's like, yeah, I like the way that, you know, that young rich girl from Westchester, you know, when she walks around, it's like,
give her a book.
Pleasant whiff. Yeah. It is that simple. It really is that simple. And it's that gross. It's that gross. It's that depressing. It's that depraved. It's that sordid. It really, 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 really is. And I'll tell you something. I mean, just being involved in fandom from a very early age, like I said, you know, I mean, the entire hardcore core of fandom is just filled with, and always has been filled with, people who have sexual variances, let's just say. They have unhealthy interest in very young children, let's just say. Or, you know, they're Oedipal basket cases, you know, with Oedipus complexes. So, you know, and then, you know, you wanted to talk about the occult and so on, but it's like, that's the same thing.
It all ties, you know, in together. Yeah, it all ties in together.
Kind of people, you know, it's like, nobody, nobody healthy and balanced is drawn to the occult. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Right. It's just like the occult is not for people who have this shit together.
Right.
It really isn't. It's either for people who feel that they've gotten a very rough shake out of life and sort of want to appeal to hidden powers to overcome that, mm-hmm. or it's just like rich perverts. You know, right. you know, that's what I say about Satanism. It's either dumpy losers or rich perverts, right? that's what Satanism is. It's like,
and mix it all together, and somehow we get our modern comic book industry today.
Well, I mean, there's so many crossovers now. Because of, you know, this the constant sort of collapse of the culture, right? The collapse of a consensus culture. You know, the weirdos are getting weirder. And, you know, like I said, they're getting, I mean, a lot of these people are really heavy, you know, heavily into feeding the whole trans movement, right? I mean, comic books, you know, all the trans people that I knew about for very many years were in the comics industry or in and out of the comics industry, right?
They just couldn't make up their mind on that either, huh?
Well, it is. It's all psychosexual trauma. Mm-hmm. I mean,
and certainly played out in most of our superhero origin stories as well. I mean, almost every superhero origin story has a tragedy with the parent, or abuse by the parent, or some combination thereof.
But I mean, you're right. But it's just like, just put a character like Batman in real life context. You know, like the classic Batman. Like, why is he running around with this like half naked 8-year-old boy? Right? Like, what the hell is that? You know? Because if you look at Robin in the original comics, I mean, he's a baby. You know what I mean? He's a child. And like, who thought that was a good idea? Like,
it's
one
of those things that it's so imbued in the culture, and we think of Adam West Batman and the goofy teenage Robin, that when you never stop to actually think about it for 2 seconds, what is happening here? This older man running around in tights with a little teenager, and then you realize that Robin was actually 8 in the original, and then you're just like, what the? How was this ever okay?
Well, I'll tell you something. One of the other characters that I've looked a lot into because it's a mess is Wonder Woman. And, you know, the guy who invented Wonder Woman was, a psychological, he's one of the Army's first psychological warfare professors, right? One of the first people who taught the skills of psychological warfare, right? And then he was sort of kicking around when the comics got real popular in the early 40s. And then he pitched his idea to, it's hard to explain, but it wasn't actually DC itself. It was sort of like an auxiliary company, but it's neither here nor there. But anyhow, so then he starts Wonder Woman. And if you go back and look at those Wonder Woman, it's the most perverted shit you'll ever see in your life. It's all like bondage and little kids. And it's just disgusting. It's just so perverted. And actually there's a woman. So, you know, this is back in the day when parents actually cared about their kids and what they were consuming. And so to sort of keep the parents quiet, DC would hire these luminaries, you know, to sort of give their blessings to the books. And one of the people who they hired was a sort of like a pop psychologist, right? Sort of like a Sally Jesse Raphael of her time, called Josette Frank. And she was supposed to sit there and like just sign off and say, oh, don't worry, parents, this stuff is great. And what broke her was Wonder Woman. She said, I forget the exact way she said it, but she said, an out and out striptease would be less unwholesome than this disaster. You know, she just said, this is perverted. These comics are perverted. This is disgusting. And she quit, and she walked away from like a plum gig. She was making pretty good money. And the woman who replaced her was a woman named Loretta Bender, who is just basically MK Ultra before MK Ultra was MK Ultra. I mean, she's sort of like the founding mother of MK Ultra. I mean, this woman was a monster, an absolute monster, and was doing mass human experimentation on children at Bellevue Hospital. Wow. You know, basically pumping them full of like insulin. And then when, you know, basically killing them and just sort of seeing what would happen, right? Just like, this is like Auschwitz stuff, right? And then when LSD came in, she would like, these kids, these orphans, a lot of them were like mentally handicapped in the, in, you know, in these public houses, these, you know, hospitals and so on. She was pumping these like small children full of like ridiculous doses of LSD, ridiculous doses. It was horrific. It was the most horrific thing. And she's the woman who DC hires to basically tell parents, oh, don't worry, this stuff is great. This stuff is great. Wow. Now, there's a guy who, when I was growing up with all the boomers, was like a big villain, this guy named Frederick Wortham, right? And he wrote a book called Seduction of the Innocent. And this guy's one of my heroes. And he's been my, I remember when I was working on, he became my hero when I was working on A Gods Wear Spandex, or I sort of idolized him before, because I always grew up with all these like boomer weirdos telling me that, you know, how horrible this guy was, right? But he was a guy who wrote a book called Seduction of the Innocent and just basically said, you know, this shit is fucked. And these, the people who are making this stuff are fucked. And that they're screwing with, they're exposing kids to violence and gore and all this sexual weirdness, S&M, all this like ridiculous stuff. These kids are way too young for it, and it's having a terrible effect on them. And he was right. He was absolutely right. And if you go back and you look at some of those comics before he came along, I mean, some of the stuff is stuff that you wouldn't even see in like an R-rated movie, like some of the horror comics. And I'm like, yeah, this guy took a lot of heat, became sort of like this, you know, villain, super villain character. But he was right, because these comic books and the people publishing these comic books were disgusting. I mean, just flat out, you know, flat out. There's a company called EC, right? And it was the guy who started Mad Magazine was the publisher, right? And by the time he was doing EC, he was a wicked speed freak. He was like sort of a chubby guy and started taking speed to lose weight and everything. And I think he basically became a victim of amphetamine psychosis, because if you look at those EC comics, it's just like Texas Chainsaw Massacre kind of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. But the thing is that it was being marketed towards children, towards very young children, right? And all these boomer weirdos who never had kids or anything, they don't understand that it's not good for children. The stuff is not good for kids. You know, maybe you're just like a teenage weirdo who wants to get his rocks off on like gore and stuff. Fine, whatever. You know, do what makes you happy. But this stuff was being aimed at like 4 and 5 year olds, and it's stuff that, you know, you would see in like, what's that French movie, that horror movie, Disciples, right? Yeah. You know the movie I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Like the torture porn classic. No. And that's what,
like a modern day Hostel or a
Saw. Exactly that kind of deal. So it's not to be, you know, the comics industry, or as we knew it, which was kind of like the superhero industry, is dying pretty slow and miserable death. I mean, it's like got one foot in the grave right now, and good riddance to it. I mean, yeah, I mean, there were a lot of great stories and so on, but there was just a lot of junk, just like, yeah.
There's a reason most of the stuff we talk about on this show in terms of comics are older stuff from decades ago, not as once in a while there's a modern day gem that sneaks through, because there's certainly talented people working on this stuff, but for the most part, the modern stuff, it's as you describe it. It seems like it's just there to be there for the most part. But Chris,
it's to keep the print, you know,
right.
You would be just shocked by the motivations to publish this stuff. A lot of it is to keep the printing presses running, because these companies get discounts on volume.
Right.
So they'll publish a lot of these comics that they know nobody's going to buy, just to keep their discounts,
right.
And to keep, you know, their postage discounts and so on, shipping discounts. And it's literally that tawdry. It's literally that cheesy. And, you know, I mean, like I said, I really feel, you know, personally, I feel like very blessed to have grown up. Like, I grew up on the tail end of the Silver Age, you know, Marvel Age and so on. And then the 70s with all the weirdo hippie psychedelic stuff, right? And then like the 80s, when it was like, well, let's see what we can do with this art form. And then, you had Love and Rockets, which I was a huge fan of, Nexus, American Flag. And then, like I said, like Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen. But that was when they hit the wall. They're like, there was nowhere else to go after that. Mm-hmm. There really wasn't. There was nothing else to be said about superheroes that was meaningful after Dark Knight and Watchmen. There really wasn't, because that took it to its logic. Those two series took superheroes to the logical extreme, and there was literally nowhere else to go. And that was almost 40 years ago. Okay. So there you go.
Chris, certainly appreciate you bringing on your perspective on this. And of course, people can follow your work if they're at all interested in not just the comic book related stuff, but all things really occult symbolism and occult related stuff that goes on in our pop culture. You're pretty much on top of all of it. So, of course, I mentioned the Secret Summon blog, but feel free to reference anything else you got going on that people should
read. Yes.
Any books you got going on, feel free to rattle it off.
I've got a book coming out hopefully early July, called The Spandex Files. Which is my my farewell to the comic. This is a very time, it's a very time.
As I say, it's a good time. I didn't even know about that one.
Yeah, so this is sort of my this is my bon voyage to comics and superheroes and stuff. And listen, I mean, I'm very grateful. I raised a family working as an artist, mm-hmm. For Marvel and so on. I'm grateful for that. I'm not one of these thanks for the dinner, go fuck yourself. It's like, I appreciate it, and there are a lot of good people who did a lot of good work, mm-hmm. But the well is now run dry and it's all over but the shouting. And I would be surprised if most of the superhero movie projects that are in development right now survive the writer's strike.
I was wondering the same thing. I mean, survive the writer's strike, which might actually provide the perfect excuse to shut down a lot of projects that they were already foreseeing on the horizon. We're about to lose money because Marvel has this whole multiverse slate plan. DC just has this whole James Gunn slate. And I got to think they're looking around a little bit and saying, do we really just want to throw away $1 trillion on a slate of movies at this point?
Listen, the writing is on the wall. Okay, so people, went to The Flash and said, it's not that bad of a movie. I mean, it's probably no worse. People go back in like 10 years or so and go, watch The Flash and it's like, is this any worse than any of the Thor movies? Right? Is this any worse than Ant-Man movies? Right? But it's just, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but it's just like, it's over. It's just over.
I think it's also a sign that because they used to have we can always kind of fall back on a big nostalgic kick, and heck, we're going to give them the biggest one ever here with Michael Keaton. And when now that's not even working, even the nostalgia is just being met with a whimper. I think that says a lot.
Well, the interesting thing is that people are nostalgic for that first Batman movie. It's not that good a movie.
I still enjoy it even on a recent rewatch, but it's all context too. It's partially, I am aware that it's partially because I watched it when I was 9. So the nostalgia is me being 9, not for
I'm not going to argue with nostalgia. Well, listen, my sons, would watch those movies, those first two Batman movies, like practically on a loop. You know what I mean? They'd watch, this is the VCR days, right? So they'd watch Batman Returns, right? The one with
the second one, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they'd watch it, rewind it, and then watch it again. Mm-hmm. So I would never argue with anybody's nostalgia. And if people love that movie, by all means, go for it.
It's not Shakespeare is the point. It's not Stanley Kubrick here. You know?
Yeah, it's not a depthless classic is what I'm saying. And if people are nostalgic for it, I think nostalgia is perfectly valid, mm-hmm. right? I think that nostalgia gets a terrible rap. I think nostalgia is a very powerful thing that I just would never argue with. I would never try to diminish someone else's nostalgia. As a matter of fact, I kind of make that mistake in A Gods with Spandex because I just hated a lot of that 90s superhero stuff. And I kind of, I got some pushback on that. And I think I kind of learned my lesson. But I was trying to make the point because I was kind of building up because a lot of Our Gods Were Spandex was about, was kind of centered on Kingdom Come. Do you remember Kingdom Come?
Oh yeah, it's one of my favorites. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I remember that really blew me away. And it was funny because even like that is like, what are you going to say about superheroes after, you know, if you're not going to say anything about superheroes that's particularly profound after Dark Knight and Watchmen, what are you possibly going to say after?
That's the only thing I can hope for, maybe, is if, because I know James Gunn has tweeted out some like Kingdom Come. If they could actually do an awesome Kingdom Come movie, I might be there for that. But then maybe it's time to shut it down.
They never will.
That's the problem. It's not going to be what I want it to be, I'm sure.
It would cost $10 trillion to make, and they'd still do a bad job of it. It's
most likely.
And why do you need a movie of it?
I already got the good one. Right.
The comic book is perfect. You know, I mean, you're going to get a great experience just reading Kingdom Come. Yeah. And I would recommend that everybody read that.
It's one of the few stories that, you know, we do some formal type review shows here. It's one of the very few. It's a very elite group that it got a 10 out of 10 score from us.
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, I just straight up and down, everything about it is amazing and perfect and unimprovable. And again, it's like, if I thought the superheroes were over after Watchmen, I really thought they were over after Kingdom Come. I mean, it's just like,
I think it would be a fair point to point to as the absolute peak of comic storytelling or superhero storytelling.
I would not. I think it's the last great testament. It's the last great expression of superheroes. Because, you know, after that, that sort of inspired like the Ultimates. And that sort of, you know, inspired like the widescreen, the kind of like more realistic, more godlike depiction of the heroes. And that had a huge influence on Our Gods Were Spandex.
Right.
But, you know, now we're at the same period that we're at in the 80s with like the post-Watchmen, post-Dark Knight. Like, you had all these parodies, superhero parodies that came out, right? And now we've got The Boys and WandaVision and, you know, all these kind of like
smirky, darker versions of everything,
self-referential, self-mocking kind of versions of you know, I mean, The Boys is just, you know, I mean, it's just, it's
all signs of the end times, you could argue here when it comes to superheroes. But the end times
have come and went. I mean, right. we're just cleaning up the
we're just body. Hanging out in the aftermath, right?
We're just basically throwing the bodies, you know, all the bodies on the you know, on the bonfire now, and it's just, it's over.
Right.
And all we need to do is just clean up the carnage. It's never coming back, never coming back. I guarantee you it's never coming back, because it's really a vestige. Superheroes are really a vestige of Greek mythology, particularly Greek mythology, and Greek mythology that was popularized during the 1800s with the neoclassical movement. And that fed into occultism and spiritualism and theosophy, and that inspired the creation of the superheroes in the 1920s. So it's just like, there's nothing left, you know, there's no meat left on the bone. So,
well, Chrissy, thank you for coming here and you know, gnawing on a little bit of whatever's left on the bone, I guess you could say, with us. And I look forward to the new book. I'm glad I brought you on now. It's pretty good timing, so we'll definitely have an eye on it. All right, thanks so much, Chris. Take care, appreciate it.